Mostly teenagers in sporty tracksuits were trickling in, kissing everything in sight. Seeing these rough and casual teens bending respectfully at the waist as they kissed icons, Bibles, and the hands of monks was mesmerizing. If you saw them on the streets, you'd never dream they'd be here, standing through a long Orthodox service. For the first time, I understood what the iconostasis, called a rood screen in Western Europe, is all about. Used long ago in Catholic churches and still used today in Orthodox churches, the screen separates the common worshippers from the zone where the priests do all the religious heavy lifting. Behind the screen, which, like a holy lattice, provides privacy but still lets you peek through, I could see busy priests in fancy robes, and above it all, the outstretched arms of Jesus. I knew he was on the cross, but because of the height of the screen, I only saw his arms. As the candlelight flickered, I felt they were happy arms, wanting and eager to give everyone present a big, Slavic bear hug. Standing through an Eastern Orthodox service in a humble church in the forgotten historic capital of a mountain kingdom, I was thankful I had zigzagged to that remote corner of Europe. All those switchbacks earned me the chance to witness a vibrant and time-honored tradition surviving the storms of globalization and modernization. It occurred to me that places like this, with virtually zero normal tourism, often reward the curious traveler with some of the very best sightseeing. Back on the main street, in the middle of this Montenegrin nowhere, I met an American family traveling with their 91-year-old grandmother. We shared stories of beautiful times we'd each enjoyed and lessons we'd learned getting to know the people in Montenegro. The grandma said, "Traveling in places like this inspires me to keep going when I should be staying home." Alone again, I sat on Cetinje's main square. Nursing a gritty cup of coffee, I watched kids coming home from school. Two older girls walked by happily spinning the same kind of batons my sister spun when I was a tyke. And then a sweet younger girl walked by all alone, lost in thought, carrying a tattered violin case. Even in a country without its own currency, in a land where humble is everything's middle name, parents can find an old violin and manage to give their little girls grace and culture. Letting that impression breathe, it made me happier than I imagined it would. Traveling in war-torn Yugoslavia, I see how little triumphs can be big ones. I see hardscrabble nations with big aspirations. And I see the value of history in understanding our travels and the value of travel in understanding our history. Before traveling on to Chapter 3, here's a sidebar. First-hand accounts make history spring to life. Learning from a local who actually lived through the war made my Mostar visit a particularly rich experience. Thankful for the lessons I learned in Mostar, I considered the value of first-hand accounts in my travels over the years. Here are a few examples. When I was a gawky 14-year-old, my parents took me to Europe. In a dusty village on the border of Austria-Hungary, a family friend introduced me to a sage old man with breadcrumbs in his cartoonish white handlebar mustache. As the man spread lard on his rustic bread, he shared his eyewitness account of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914. I was thrilled by history as never before. Decades later, in Prague, my Czech friend, Hansa, took me on the walk he'd taken every night for a week in 1989 with 100,000 of his countrymen as they demanded freedom from their Soviet overlords. The walk culminated in front of a grand building where Hansa said, "Night after night we assembled here, pulled out our keychains, and all jangled them at the president's window, saying, 'It's time for you to go now.' And then one night we gathered and he was gone. We had won our freedom." Hearing Hansa tell that story as we walked the same route he walked drilled into me the jubilation of a small country winning its freedom. On another trip, my Norwegian uncle Tor gave me a similarly powerful experience in Oslo. gazing at mosaic murals in the Oslo City Hall that celebrate the heroics of locals who stood strong against German occupation, Tor told me stories of growing up in a Nazi-ruled Norway. He woke up one morning to find his beloved royal family in exile and German soldiers on every corner. Norway's resistance fighters took to the snowy mountains, coordinating the brave townspeople to smuggle children to safety. Despite the vastly stronger occupying force, Tor told how his country's national spirit remained strong and how everyone rejoiced on the glorious day the king returned and Norwegian flags flew happily once again. As Tor brought the mural to life, I wondered what would I do to win back a freedom lost. Recently in Northern Ireland, my guide Stephen was determined to make his country's struggles vivid. In Belfast, he introduced me to the Felons Club, where membership is limited to those who've spent at least a year and a day in a British prison for political crimes. Hearing heroic stories of Irish resistance while sharing a Guinness with a celebrity felon gives you an affinity for their struggles. Walking the next day through the green-trimmed gravesites of his prison mates, who starved themselves to death for the cause of Irish independence, capped the experience powerfully. El Salvador's history is so tragic and fascinating that anyone you talk to becomes a tour guide. My Salvadoran guides with the greatest impact were the mothers of the disappeared, who told me their story while leafing through humble scrapbooks, showing photographs of their sons' bodies, mutilated and decapitated. Learning of a cruel government's actions from those sad mothers left me with lifetime souvenirs. A cynicism about many governments, you can tell by their actions who they really represent, and an empathy for underdogs courageously standing up to their leaders when necessary. Tourists can go to Prague, Norway, Ireland, and Central America and learn nothing of a people's struggles. Or they can seek out opportunities to connect with people, whether professional guides or accidental guides, who can share perspective-changing stories. Chapter 3. Europe Unites. Successes and Struggles. While I dabble in the rest of the world, my true love is Europe. Since my first trip there in 1969, I've enjoyed gaining an appreciation for Europe's history, art, culture, cuisine, music, and politics. In my lifetime, the big news in Europe has been its gradual unification. In 1947, in the rubble of a bombed-out Europe, the continent's leaders gathered and thought, "We've dug out after horrific wars twice in our lifetime. We need to do something creative and drastic, or our children will be digging out yet again." Their solution was to unite, to weave the economies of France and Germany together so another big war between the two big continental powers would be unthinkable. Of course, a union is nothing without people giving up some measure of sovereignty. Since 1947, proponents of a European Union have been convincing the people of proud and independent nations to trade away bits and pieces of their independence. It's a tough sell, but in a fitful evolution, two steps forward and one step back, over the last seven or so decades, they have created a European Union. The European Union, or EU, has succeeded in attaining its founders' two key goals, avoiding intra-European war and integrating European economies. But for some, all of the changes have been too much, too fast. And as I read this in late 2017, Europe is facing some of its most significant challenges yet, raising the question of how much longer things can hold together. I'll admit I'm a big believer in the EU and its ideals, but in this chapter I'll also discuss some hard realities. Today, for the first time that I can remember, the future of the European Union is in doubt. EU worries aside, Europe is the part of the world most similar to the USA. That's why I consider it the wading pool for world exploration. Americans and Europeans are both affluent, well-educated peoples who love their freedom. But while we have much in common, we also have fundamental differences. I learn a lot about America by studying Europe. Europeans do some things better than we do, some things they do worse. And most things are open to debate. Europe doesn't have all the answers, but neither do we. Considering innovative European approaches to persistent challenges that vex our own nation can be constructive. This chapter assembles a few of my favorite examples. Europe's big government, high taxes with high expectations. While Europe has its share of economic woes, there's no denying that Europeans have created a vast free trade zone that keeps the continent competitive with the United States and with the emerging economic giants of China and India. With the unification of Europe, hundreds of millions of people now have the same euro coins jingling in their pockets. Although Europe has a mighty economy, they strive to balance business concerns with socialistic policies. And for most Europeans, that works well. While many American politicians present voters with two options, big bad government or little good government, Europeans believe there's a third option, big good government. In American politics, socialism is often perceived as an all-or-none bogeyman, evoking the stifling Soviet system of the Cold War. But this thinking ignores the full spectrum of socialism. Every country on Earth, including our own, includes some socialistic elements, such as our progressive taxation and the entitlements that we've come to see as the mark of a caring and civilized society. Like us, Europe is enthusiastically capitalistic. Europeans are just more comfortable with a higher degree of socialism. Most Europeans continue to favor their high and highly progressive tax rates. That's because they believe that collectively creating the society of their dreams is more important than allowing individuals to create the personal empires of their dreams. While American culture tends to be individualistic, inspired by up-from-the-bootstraps and rags-to-riches stories, Europe is more focused on community. While as a society we're more religious, Europe is more humanistic. In Scandinavia, the most highly taxed, socialistic, and humanistic corner of Europe, you don't find a church with a steeple on the main square. Instead, you'll find a city hall with a bell tower. Inside, a secular nave leads not to a pulpit, but to a lectern. Behind the lectern, a grand mosaic tells epic stories, not from the Bible, but celebrating heroic individuals who contributed mightily to their community. Europeans pay high taxes to buy big, good government, and they expect results. Those results include an extensive social welfare network that puts the financial burden of childcare, healthcare, education, and retirement on the collective shoulders of society rather than on individuals. I once asked Ollie, my Swiss friend, "How can you Swiss people be so docile about paying such high taxes?" Without missing a beat, Ollie replied, "Well, what's it worth to live in a society where there is no homelessness, no hunger, and where every child, regardless of the wealth of their parents, enjoys equal access to quality health care and education?" And Ollie is no liberal firebrand. He's considered a solid conservative leader in his community. The benefits are everywhere. A Slovenian friend of mine who had a baby was guaranteed a year's maternity leave at near full pay and was given a state-subsidized starter kit with all the essential gear she needed to care for her newborn. If anyone, even a foreign traveler, goes to a public hospital for urgent care in Europe, they often won't see the bill. Higher education in Europe is subsidized. In many countries, it's entirely free, and students even get pocket money while they're learning. Europeans consider a well-educated society fundamental to their notion of national security. Hundreds of thousands of students and professors have traveled to other EU countries to study, teach, and build a sprawling network of intra-European relations through the EU-funded Erasmus program. Don't get me wrong, Europeans grumble about paying sky-high taxes as much as anyone, and tax evasion is a national pastime for many. But philosophically, they understand that when it comes to taxes, the necessity outweighs the evil. European politicians don't have to promise tax cuts to win elections. Many European voters support high taxes and big government because they like what they get in return. The flip side of this system is that Europe doesn't have the ethic of individual charitable giving that we have here in the U.S. We go to auctions and bake sales to support a good cause. We help our children raise money to subsidize school activities. Our local orchestras wouldn't exist without financial gifts from donors committed to that slice of culture. And public television is made possible through the generous support from viewers like you. You don't see that so much in Europe. Europeans, because of their taxes, expect the government to care for the needy and educate young people and support the arts. Europe's tax-funded alternative to charity auctions, pledge drives, and school car washes works for them. In our system, the thinking is that after we all get wealthy, we'll be sure to make charitable contributions to the places where the fabric of our society is frayed. But Europe is more socialistic. Rather than 1,000 points of light emanating from generous community members who care, Europeans prefer one compassionate, well-organized, and collectively funded searchlight from the entire society orchestrated by elected officials. While we care individually, they care collectively. Features that are perceived as good for the fabric of their community, such as bike lanes, heroin maintenance clinics, quality non-commercial broadcasting, after-school child care for working parents, paid maternity and paternity leave, and freeway art, take priority over personal interests. Through progressive taxation, everyone contributes according to their ability and regardless of the size of their heart. Both the United States and Europe are enthusiastic about government by, for, and of the people. But I've noticed a fundamental difference. In America, this is by, for, and of the people via the corporations we own. In other words, we think the primary role of government is to create an economic atmosphere where the corporations we own can prosper. I was raised with the business mantra, what's good for GM is good for America. In Europe, on the other hand, they choose government by, for, and of the people in spite of the corporations they own. Their government would more likely go to bat for the environment, the poor, the future, and the long-term interests of society. Their attitude, what's good for the worker, is good for corporate Europe. Consequently, Europe is willing to consider laws that are, at least in the narrow view, bad for business. While in Europe, the notion of paying for a car's disposal when you first buy the car makes sense, it would be dismissed in the U.S. as bad for the economy. Because carbon taxes are considered good for the environment but bad for business, I doubt you'll see them anytime soon in the United States, but several European countries already have them. Even as Europeans accept this system, they love to complain about the heavy-handedness of big government. Cumbersome bureaucracy creeps into virtually all aspects of European life. Strict health codes for restaurants dictate that cooked food must be frozen if it's not served within 3 hours. My Czech friend complains, this makes many of our best dishes illegal. Czech specialties, often simmered overnight, taste better the next day. A Polish farmer I know gripes that when Poland joined the EU, he had to get passports for each of his cows. Italians chafed at having to wear helmets while riding their otherwise stylish motorini. Throughout the EU, people are struggling to compromise as one-size-fits-all governance takes a toll on some of their particular passions. Frustrations with these kinds of regulations, coming from Brussels rather than from London, is the reason why many people from the United Kingdom voted for Brexit. While Europeans seem to find clever ways to get government on their backs, the American chorus has long been, get the government off our backs. We don't want regulations, especially the extreme examples cited above. America has long had a less regulated business environment than Europe, and even smartly motivated attempts to create common-sense regulations, such as the reforms put in place after the 2008 financial crisis, are rolled back as soon as the electorate's short memory will allow. More recently, a whole spectrum of regulations designed to rein in banks, protect consumers, defend civil liberties, and protect the environment have been branded job killers. On the other hand, in Europe, workers' protection environmental protection, and what seems like an obsession for regulations in general make it tough for a small employer to survive. Europe is a challenging, even demoralizing environment for running a small business. While I appreciate the way Europe organizes much of its society, I'm thankful I run my business here in America rather than there. In Europe, I could never have the creative fun I enjoy as an entrepreneur here in the USA. Is the American approach wrong and Europe's approach right? As a taxpayer and as a job creator, I see pros and cons to both systems. We can all benefit by comparing notes. Europeans work less. One priority of the European approach is striking a comfortable work-life balance. The EU has about 500 million people with an annual economy of around $16 trillion. To put that into relative terms, the United States, with around 300 million people, has an economy of approximately the same size. Proponents of the American system point out that Europeans don't make as much money as we do. It's true, with more people generating only the same gross economy, they produce and earn less per person. But Western European workers make essentially the same per hour as ours do. They just choose to work fewer hours. I was raised believing there was one good work ethic. You work hard. While we call this the work ethic, it's actually only a work ethic. Europeans have a different one. They choose to work fewer hours than Americans do and willingly make correspondingly less income. In recent years, both Germany and France have made it illegal for workers to email or call each other outside of work hours except in cases of emergency. Yes, that's a blow to productivity, at least in the short term. But they believe it prevents long-term burnout, ultimately benefiting everyone. While this approach may not be good for business, Europeans consider it good for living. Choosing to work less is part of family values in Europe. Meanwhile, here in business-friendly America, working less is frowned upon, almost subversive. A Greek friend of mine spent 20 years working in New York. Only after he retired and returned to Greece did he realize that not once in all those years in America did he take a nap. Back in Greece, if he's sleepy in the afternoon, he takes a snooze. Europeans marvel at how Americans seem willing, almost eager to work themselves into an early grave. My European friends have told me proudly, we don't live to work, we work to live. Europeans understand the trade-off. Because they choose to work less, most Europeans don't strive for the material affluence that their American counterparts do. European housing, cars, gadgets, and other stuff are modest compared to what an American with a similar job might own. It's a matter of priorities. Just as Europeans willingly pay higher taxes for a higher standard of service, they choose less pay and less stuff in exchange for more time off. Imagine this in your life. Would you make do with a smaller car if you knew you didn't have to pay health insurance premiums? Would you be willing to give up the luxury of a cutting-edge TV and live in a smaller house if you could cut back to 35 hours per work week and get a few extra weeks of paid vacation? Would you settle for a 10% pay cut if you knew you'd never get an email or phone call from the office outside of work hours? For most Americans, I imagine that the European idea of spending more time on vacation and with their family instead of putting in hours of overtime is appealing. I have an American friend who runs a very small movement called Take Back Your Time. Its mission? To teach Americans that we have the shortest vacations in the rich world, and it's getting worse. His movement's national holiday is October 24th. That's because, by its estimates, if we accepted only the typical European workload, yet worked as long and hard as we do in the U.S., October 24th would be the last day of the year we'd have to go to work. However, with the pressures of globalization, Europe is rethinking some of its live-more-work-less ideals. For example, the Spanish government is funding incentives to keep workers from going home for a midday siesta, which most agree hurts productivity. And I have a theory that in Ireland, where sales of Guinness are down, the number of pubs has shrunk at the same rate that the number of cafes has increased as that society has ramped up its productivity. drinkers of heavy stout have shifted to lighter lagers, and drinkers of lager have shifted to coffee. Replacing alcohol with caffeine is a symptom of our faster-paced, more competitive world. And now, particularly in Europe's big business-oriented cities, American-style chains allow workers to get their coffee to go. An integrated economy. The pros and cons. One of the most remarkable feats of a united Europe has been the integration of its economy. Trade barriers between European nations are a thing of the past, and the euro currency has replaced 19 separate national currencies. Imagine, since 2002, the same coins are used in Lisbon, Tallinn, Dublin, and Thessaloniki, and most of Europe functions as a vast free trade zone. However, with the global financial crisis starting in 2008, Europeans realized that what goes up together must come down together. They've learned the hard way that neighboring countries can have vastly different philosophies about fiscal prudence. The EU designed the euro to be a hard currency, with minimal inflation and maximum stability. It favors export nations that shun deficit spending, and it punishes countries that like to borrow a lot to inflate their debts away. Considering these standards, some countries, like Germany, are more worthy of the euro than others, like Greece, and there's no convenient way to uninvite a eurozone member. When a nation joins the European Union, it's either a net contributor or a net receiver. While there's lots of wrangling in Brussels about just who gives and gets what, Europeans know their economic union is only as strong as its weakest link. Therefore, wealthy countries give more than they get, willingly, if not always enthusiastically. That money bolsters the poorer countries. And eventually, in theory, those countries develop to the point where, rather than weak links, they become net contributors as well. But it hasn't quite worked out that way. Think about the vast diversity the Eurozone attempts to corral. Germans are as famous for their work ethic as Spaniards are for their aimless paseo wanderings. A nation of workaholics or a nation of layabouts can function just fine, provided everyone's on the same page. But when hard-working folk begin to feel that they're propping up their less productive compatriots in other countries, things get testy. Things reached a head during the economic crisis of the early 2010s when Europe paid the price in the form of expensive bailouts and painful cutbacks for what had been taken-for-granted services. It's no coincidence that the European countries that have received the most development aid, those are the so-called pigs countries, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, are the ones that have been the most debt-ridden and the ones that suffered the most with the economic crisis. Even with significant EU aid, their productivity has lagged far behind the stronger economies. And yet, although their workforce doesn't produce as much per capita as German workers, they still have a mighty currency that's tied to Germany. By earning wages in euros and getting aid in euros, these nations enjoyed a false prosperity that they might not have actually earned, and their bursting real estate bubble made it worse. Before European unity, if a nation didn't produce much and slid into crippling debt, it could make itself competitive by simply devaluing its currency, and by doing so, decrease society-wide what laborers were paid in real terms. But the euro makes that impossible. Effectively, everyone gets the Deutschmark, whether they deserve it or not. In 2012, a feisty political debate erupted between two nations with diametrically opposed fiscal worldviews. Greece grabbed headlines for the severity of its economic woes and its apparent inability to resolve them. For a while, it seemed the Greek crisis might undo the euro currency and possibly the entire EU. Germany, which generates more than a quarter of the EU's total GDP and is the biggest net contributor to the EU's budget, decided it would no longer bankroll other countries' debt problems without having a say in its future economic standards. Chancellor Angela Merkel was willing to help bail out Greece, but her offer had strings attached. The Greeks must embrace reforms and learn to live within their means, a new standard that would be enforced by strict fiscal benchmarks. Many Greeks on the street chafed at the suggestion that they should give up promised vacations and retirements and be forced to adopt a Germanic nose-to-the-grindstone work ethic. But eventually, the Greeks accepted the bailout with those strings. Things stabilized, but many fear the problem will likely resurface. Will there come a day when Greek voters decide a Grexit, a Greek version of Brexit, is the least worst option for their economic future? Only the future knows. Europe's internal Marshall Plan. Periodic controversies aside, Europe strives to put its tax revenue to good use. The EU is dedicated to continually upgrading its infrastructure. After World War II, the United States invested in rebuilding Europe with the Marshall Plan. It was a smart policy designed to assure us strong and stable trading partners and allies. Over the last couple decades, for essentially the same reasons, Europe has employed a kind of internal Marshall Plan, investing hundreds of billions of euros in roads, rail lines, communication, education, and other improvements to strengthen their union. Travelers not only see this, they benefit from it. Trains are faster than ever. Recently on a bullet train in France, I enjoyed a smooth and silent 200-mile-per-hour ride through pastoral countryside. As if the rail company was ashamed of the slower stretches, the speedometer was only illuminated when the train exceeded 300 kilometers per hour. That's 186 miles per hour. On a visit to Munich, I was photographing trains pulling into the station, with birds squished onto the windshields. Looking at those poor birds, I thought, you'd wait all your life to see a bird squished onto the windshield of a train back in my hometown. Consider the infrastructure. A bullet train now zips under the English Channel, taking people from Paris to London in 2.5 hours. Denmark and Sweden built a mammoth bridge connecting Copenhagen and Malmo, creating Scandinavia's largest metropolitan area. And cities throughout Europe seem to be forever dug up because they're constantly improving and expanding their underground transit systems. Non-EU nations are investing too. Norway, with fewer than 5 million people, has drilled some of the longest tunnels in the world to lace together isolated communities in the fjords. Istanbul scraped together the money to build a massive train tunnel under the Bosporus to connect Asia and Europe and Greece its economic engine. And there's even an effort being considered to dig a tunnel connecting Spain and Morocco under the Strait of Gibraltar. Savvy nations understand that infrastructure is the foundation for prosperity and power. Hitler knew he couldn't take on Europe without a good highway system, so he built the Autobahn. The United States undertook a massive investment in our interstate highway system back in the 1950s. This helped our country, with rich and poor states enjoying equal quality federally funded roads, truck itself into greater economic power. And in our generation, Europe is investing money it could be spending on its military, on its infrastructure instead. Exploring a continent with a level of affluence similar to the United States gives us a chance to see firsthand the result of allocating limited resources with different priorities. People everywhere hear the excuse, there's not enough money. But there's plenty of money. Travelers see vividly that each society makes different choices according to its own priorities. Some societies may prioritize for tax cuts, new stadiums, and next-generation bombers. Others may opt for health care for all, faster trains, and subsidized education. Again, it's a societal choice. Europe wants peace. So far, I've focused on the economy of the European Union. But for the EU's founders, money took a back seat to their primary motivation, peace. And even today, peace is the single greatest and most underrated success of the European Union. Even the biggest Euroskeptic recognizes that European countries have become so interconnected that Europe will never again suffer devastation from a major war as they did twice in the last century. The French and the Germans still don't agree on many things, but they've become too financially interdependent to take up arms over their differences. Minimizing the possibility of an intra-European war is the triumph of the EU. If boots do hit the ground in a war, Europeans believe it will be because they have failed to prevent it. They prefer endless diplomacy to once-in-a-while war. Europe's reluctance to go to war frustrates some Americans. I believe their relative pacifism is because Europeans know the reality of war, while most Americans do not. Of course, if you have a loved one who has fought or died in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Vietnam, you know what a war is. But as a society, the United States can't remember actually hosting a war. Europeans have told me that they believe the United States is more willing to use its military muscle because in the age of modern warfare, no American city has ever been bombed like Coventry, Dresden, Rotterdam, or Warsaw. It's easy to feel detached when a war is something you watch on the nightly news rather than something that killed your grandfather or destroyed your hometown. Europe knows what a war is. It ripped itself to shreds twice within my grandparents' lifetime. Consider France's losses in World War I. France, with one quarter as many people as we have, lost as many people as the United States lost in the entire Iraq War. That's over 4,000 people in one day, many times. They lost as many people as we lost in Vietnam, 60,000, in one month. And then it happened again and again, until by the end of World War I, an estimated half of all the men in France between the ages of 15 and 30 were casualties. When some Americans, aggravated by France's unwillingness to take up arms, call the French surrender monkeys, I believe it shows their ignorance of history. Fewer borders, but more ethnic diversity. A key strategy for preserving peace in a sprawling, multi-ethnic state is to respect and celebrate diversity. As if inspired by America's E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one, the European Union's official motto is In Veritate Concordia, United in Diversity. I'm charmed by Europe's diversity. Hop on a train for 2 hours and you step out into a different culture, different language, different heritage. As I watched Europe unite, I, like many of my European friends, feared that this diversity would be threatened. But just the opposite is happening. Europe is actually becoming more diverse. In today's Europe, there are three loyalties: region, nation, and Europe. A person from Munich could consider himself Bavarian, German, and European. Ask someone from Florence where she's from, she could say, I'm Tuscan, or I'm Italian, or I'm European. Borders and loyalties can be messy. Modern political borders are rarely clean when it comes to dividing ethnic groups. And most of the terrorism and troubles in Europe, whether Basque, Irish, Catalan, or Corsican, have been about ethnic minority separatist movements threatening national capitals. Appreciating the needs of these people, peace-loving European leaders strive to make the continent's minority groups feel like they belong. While they may feel ignored at the national level, they get a seat at the table in Brussels. Brittany, in western France, is not ethnically French. People there are Celtic, cousins of the Welsh and the Irish. Just a couple generations ago, Paris was so threatened by the secessionist dreams of these Celts that if parents gave their newborn a Celtic name, that child would not be granted a French national identity card. Such a policy today would be laughable. When I first visited Barcelona in the 1970s, locals weren't allowed to speak Catalan or dance their beloved sardana. The Catalan flag was outlawed, so locals showed their patriotic spirit by waving the flag of the Barcelona soccer team instead. Now, in public schools, children speak Catalan first. Local flags fly proudly, and every Sunday in front of the cathedral, people gather to dance the sardana. This circle dance symbolizes national unity as all differences are cast aside, and Catalans raise their hands together to proudly celebrate their ethnicity. A Catalan person in Barcelona told me, Catalunya is Spain's Quebec. We don't like people calling our corner of Iberia a region of Spain, because that's what Franco called it. We do not accept subjugation as a region of Spain. We are a nation without a state. So what's going on? Barcelona is standing up to Madrid. London is respecting Cardiff. Brittany gets along with Paris. And I don't mean Spears and Hilton. As power shifts to the EU capital of Brussels, national capitals recognize and accept that their authority is waning. And the European Union supports these nations without states. A friend of mine, Armin Walsh, is the Indiana Jones of Tyrolean archaeologists. Bursting with ideas and projects, he loves to renovate castles in Western Austria. When Armin wants money to excavate a castle, he doesn't go to Vienna. He goes to Brussels. If he says, "I'm doing something for Austria," he'll go home empty-handed. So instead, he says he's doing something for the Tyrol, an ethnic region that spans parts of Italy and Austria, ignoring modern national boundaries, and Armin gets the funding. The European Union is burdened with the image of a too politically correct bureaucracy, notorious for dictating the proper curve of a cucumber in 24 official languages. But they don't mind the teasing. While attempting to honor the linguistic and idealistic wishes of its unruly gang of members isn't always efficient, Europe understands that watching out for its ethnic underdogs is essential for maintaining its hard-won peace. Nations without states. Modern national boundaries don't always match up with the local ethnic breakdown, and even seemingly homogeneous Europe has several nations without states. That's nations, groups of like-minded people united by language, culture, and bloodlines that don't have an internationally recognized country to call home. The Basques, the Catalans, the Tyroleans, the Welsh, the Bretons, and so on. How did these people wind up without a homeland? Either they were left out when modern maps were drawn, or their ancestors were planted there generations ago. History has demonstrated again and again that national borders that ignore ethnic realities will sooner or later bring big problems. That's why the EU astutely looks out for the rights of these nations without states. The Basques were a victim of not having a seat at the map-drawing table. Eons ago, when they drew the line between the French and the Spanish people, the Basques said, "Hey, what about us?" They were told, "Learn to speak French," or "Learn to speak Spanish." Centuries later, in the 1980s and 90s, the word Basque became synonymous with guerrilla terrorism through the military separatist group ETA. But Basque anger faded as a result of the EU fostering more autonomy and therefore more dignity for Europe's small ethnic regions. And in 2017, the ETA finally gave up its guns and renounced violence. The border-drawing problem extends well beyond Europe. A century ago, after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, European colonial powers drew lines in the sands of Africa and the Middle East. Creating countries like Libya, Iraq, and Syria, they ignored ethnic and sectarian divisions. These thoughtlessly created countries made little sense ethnically, and therefore to this day, their stability requires rule by a strong man. Decades later, when Western powers were busy promoting democracy, they supported the overthrow of such leaders, like Libya's Muammar Gaddafi and Iraq's Saddam Hussein. The result? Failed states, chaos, and millions of desperate, displaced people. Most of the people flooding into Europe during the 2015 refugee crisis originated from lands created by Europe that were doomed to fail. Perhaps that's why, at least subconsciously, much of Europe sees the moral imperative in welcoming and housing many of these refugees. Drawing borders with a respect to ethnic divisions sounds sensible. But in some places, where sizable minority groups are intermixed with a large and dominant majority population, it's far from simple. In many of these cases, the minority groups didn't wind up where they are by choice, but were planted by governments. This is a story repeated time and again through history. For example, in the 20th century, military families from Soviet Russia were encouraged to retire in Little Estonia. Moscow's agenda? To dilute the Estonian population and weaken that rebellious society by creating a large Russian minority. Today, Estonia, now independent, struggles with a big Russian minority that refuses to integrate. In the 16th century, the Habsburg monarchy planted Serbs, who were escaping from the Ottomans further south, along the Croatian-Bosnian border to provide a human shield against those same Ottomans. Many centuries later, descendants of those Serb settlers and the indigenous Croats were embroiled in some of the bloodiest fighting of the war following the breakup of Yugoslavia. Europe's nations without states live in solidarity with each other. In Barcelona, the Catalan people find Basque and Galician bars a little more appealing than the run-of-the-mill Spanish ones. They even make a point to include the other languages on their ATMs. You'll see Catalan first, then Spanish, Gallego, the language of Galicia in northwest Spain, Euskara, the Basque tongue, and then buttons for all the rest, English, French, German, and so on. While all of these groups, Catalan, Galicia, and Basque, speak the common language of Spanish, they respect each other's native tongues as a way to honor their shared ethnic underdog status. These groups' affinity for each other even factors into where they travel. On a recent trip to North Ireland, I was impressed by how many travelers I met from Basque country and Catalonia. Because the Basques and Catalans feel a kinship with the Catholic minority in Ireland's Protestant north, many choose to vacation there. The opposite is also true. Majority groups who strive to establish their control over disputed land empathize with each other. On that same trip to Northern Ireland, I was puzzled to see Israeli flags flying from flagpoles in Protestant communities. It's because Protestants planted there in the 17th century by a bigger power, England, have struggled with their indigenous neighbors, much like Israeli settlers in the West Bank clash with the native Palestinians. Back when Britain ruled Ceylon, present-day Sri Lanka, and used it as a big tea plantation, they couldn't get the local Sinhalese people to pick the tea cheaply enough, so they imported Tamils from India, who were more desperate and willing to work for less. When colonial rule became more trouble than the tea was worth, the Brits gave the island its freedom. But, thanks in part to England's love of tea and unwillingness to pay a fair local wage, the Sinhalese and Tamils found themselves locked in a tragic 26-year-long civil war. When I consider the problems that come with planting Tamils in Sinhalese Sri Lanka, Israelis in Palestine, Protestants in Ireland, Serbs in Croatia, and Russians in Estonia, I'm impressed both by the spine of the people who were there first and by the hardship borne by the original settlers. Ideally, every nation would have its own state. But in most cases, it's impossible to humanely disentangle quarreling people whose ancestors were let down by a short-sighted ruler. And so, the only viable option is to coexist peacefully, with a respect both for the mainstream cultural norms and the rights of the minority. Travelers who observe this sort of sectarian strife firsthand better understand that respecting diversity, rather than using it as a wedge, results in a more peaceful world for everyone. And it makes me particularly thankful that the EU prioritizes the rights of nations without states. European challenges. An aging continent grapples with immigration. I am a Europhile. I freely admit that I have a romantic fascination with Europe and an appreciation for its way of life. But I'm not blind to the fact that Europe has its flaws and is grappling, not always very well, with some serious challenges of its own. For years, both the U.S. and Europe have been consuming more goods than we produce and importing more than we export. Through the first decade of this century, everybody overspent. The United States overspent on military endeavors and tax cuts. Europe overspent on infrastructure and entitlements. And individuals in both places committed to mortgages they couldn't really afford. By riding wild real estate bubbles and creating an economy designed to generate profit by rearranging the furniture without actually producing anything, we conned ourselves into thinking we were wealthier than we actually were. When the economic crisis hit in 2008, it suddenly became clear that the world's booming economy was existing on borrowed time. The resulting Great Recession hit people hard on both sides of the Atlantic. The collapse of the housing bubble, the huge financial hit of bailing out troubled banks, and the incalculable expense of other corporate malfeasance devastated European economies, making it even more challenging for them to finance their generous entitlements. Further complicating matters are Europe's shifting population demographics. Europe's luxurious cradle-to-grave welfare system was conceived in a post-war society with lots of people working, fewer living to retirement, and retirees having a short lifespan. Originally, this plan was smart, compassionate, and sustainable. The success of Europe's social system has helped make the continent better educated and wealthier. But when a society becomes smarter and richer, two things happen. People live longer, and they have fewer children. And so, the demographic makeup of Europe has flipped upside down. Relatively few people working, lots of people retiring, and retirees living a long time. In short, Europe is becoming a geriatric continent. With fewer young workers and more seniors, the arithmetic just isn't there to sustain the lavish entitlements Europeans have come to expect. As in the USA, it's difficult to take away expected entitlements without a fight. Politicians in Europe have the unenviable task of explaining to their citizens that they just won't get the cushy golden years their parents got. People who worked diligently with the promise of retiring at 62 are now told they'll need to work extra years, and even then, they may not have a generous pension waiting for them. I expect you'll see lots of marches and lots of strikes in Europe in the coming years. They're marching in opposition to policies forced by globalization. They're marching because they're angry, thinking that foreigners are gaming the system and getting entitlements at the expense of good patriotic local workers. Even though in actuality most experts see a net contribution to societies from their immigrant population. And they're marching in protest as Europe recalibrates their long-established entitlements to fit the new, older demographic makeup of their economy. Europeans demonstrate with gusto. It's in their blood. It's a healthy part of their democracy. Workers stick up for their rights, demanding and often getting better conditions. When frustrated and needing to vent grievances, they hit the streets. I've been caught up in huge and boisterous marches all over Europe. It's not scary. In fact, it's kind of exhilarating. La manifestation, as they say in France. All that marching is just too much trouble for many Americans. When dealing with similar frustrations, we find a website or news outlet that affirms our beliefs and then shake our collective fists vigorously. Interestingly, as Europe's native population declines, its population growth may come largely from immigrants. And Europe's immigration challenges are much like America's. Around the world, rich nations import poor immigrants to do their dirty work. If a society doesn't want to pay for expensive apples picked by rich kids at high wages, it gets cheaper apples by hiring people willing to work for less. If you're wealthy enough to hire an immigrant to clean your house, you do it. You get a clean house, and the immigrant earns a wage. If you don't want to trade away your personal freedom to care for an aging parent, you hire someone else to care for them, and it's generally an immigrant. That's just the honest reality of capitalism. In Europe, Gastarbeiter, German for guest worker, is the generic term for this arrangement. Germans famously imported Turkish people to do their scut work a generation or two ago when Germany's post-World War II economic boom finally kicked into gear. These days, virtually every country in Western Europe has its own Gastarbeiter contingent. Berlin, with more than 200,000 Turks, could be considered a sizable Turkish city. France's population includes millions of poor North Africans. And even Ireland, after its Celtic Tiger boom in the early 2000s, imported 120,000 Polish people to take out its trash. At the time, it was striking to hear my Irish friends speak about their new Polish workers as if they were a new appliance. But invariably, wealthy people begin to realize that their cheap labor is not quite as cheap as they hoped. In Europe, the importation of labor creates fast-growing immigrant communities that need help and incentives to assimilate, or society at large will pay a steep price. As we saw in 2005, when the deaths of two black teenagers while being pursued by French cops ignited violent riots that rocked the underserved African and Arab suburbs of Paris. In Europe, many immigrants melt into their adopted homelands, while others flat out don't want to assimilate. With the increasing affordability of modern communication technologies, it's very easy for immigrants to establish insulated satellite communities that remain in constant contact with the culture and language of their homeland. These days, it seems that immigrant groups can choose whether or not they want to integrate into their adopted countries. I've met third-generation Algerians in the Netherlands who don't speak a word of Dutch and don't expect their children to either. And I've met first-generation Pakistanis in Denmark who speak only Danish and know and love their adopted country just as their blonde neighbors do. Like the U.S., Europe is suffering growing pains when it comes to its immigrants. Coming from an immigrant family and a nation of immigrants myself, I like America's melting pot approach. I think it works best for all if newcomers embrace their adopted culture, learn the local language, and melt in. But the European scene is a bit more complex. The critical difference, of course, is that 99% of Americans descend from immigrants, whereas much of Europe has been largely homogeneous for millennia. In some European countries, large-scale immigration is a fairly recent phenomenon. This makes many Europeans particularly vigilant about ensuring that Europe's homegrown culture continues to thrive. I share their concern, and yet it's easy to fall into contradictions. If diversity is a tenet of EU beliefs, what's wrong with immigrants wanting to preserve their home cultures? Is it hypocritical to celebrate the preservation of the Catalan language, but expect Algerians to learn Dutch? Should Europe's famous tolerance extend only to indigenous European cultures? Well, I'm glad I'm not a policymaker who needs to implement immigration laws in Europe. I'll be honest about my take on this dicey issue. I favor policies that promote indigenous diversity for European nations without states and policies that encourage assimilation for immigrants and refugees who come from outside Europe. The refugee crisis and its impact on the EU. There's a big difference between immigration, allowing foreigners to join your country to be part of your workforce, and refugees, people literally taking refuge, entering a country either legally or illegally, because it's dangerous for them to stay in their homeland. Europe has long received a steady stream of mostly economic refugees from miserably poor countries. But in 2015, that stream became a flood of war refugees, as well over a million desperate people deluged the EU, mostly from war-torn Syria. When most people use the term refugee crisis, they mean the practical challenge of housing, feeding, transporting, and generally taking care of this huge influx of humanity. But I think the real refugee crisis is the human cost of a failed state. The refugees coming to Europe today are a direct result of poorly drawn borders by European colonial powers a century ago. If Europeans or Americans complain about the hardship of housing those refugees, they should ponder the hardship brought about by their ancestors' greedy colonial policies a century ago. Meanwhile, caring people around the world wonder, what's the pragmatic and humane response? It calls for a two-pronged approach. First, deal humanely with the refugees who made it out. Much of Europe has risen to this occasion, especially Germany, which took in more than 1 million refugees in 2015. But that only addresses the result of the underlying problem, which brings me to my second point. We also have to work diligently to address the root causes of the tragedy. It's fair to assume that war refugees would rather stay in their homeland if there were a political and economic environment there where hope for a good life was realistic. Whenever the movement of desperate people flares up, travelers ask me how their European vacation might be affected. From a practical perspective, the potential impact on travelers is essentially zero. But rather than just worrying about whether you need to show up a little early for your train at a refugee-jammed station, I'd challenge you to be open to being impacted, in an emotional sense, by Europe's new arrivals. If you meet a refugee, consider it an opportunity to put a face on the headlines. Each one of these people was forced to leave their home and the life they'd built to avoid being killed by the horrors of war. Try to imagine the hardships they've gone through. Surviving the war at home, making the painful decision to leave, sorting out their possessions, saying goodbye to loved ones, and then having to clear hurdle after hurdle of red tape just to get this far. And for many, their journey is far from over. If you think you're being inconvenienced by crossing paths with them, just imagine how they must feel. Politically, the refugee crisis represents another big challenge for the European Union. Again, as Europe ages, it needs young labor. Europe can easily absorb the millions of refugees currently on its soil into its economy if those refugees can just get to the more prosperous countries that might welcome them with job opportunities. And yet, the sensationalistic news media, and people's increasing inclination to get their news through social media, have made the refugee situation seem more dangerous and more frightening than it actually is. Fear-mongering, nativist political groups are stoking that fear and anxiety, which in turn creates a hunger for more law and order and stronger borders. As one of the pet issues of ultra-nationalistic, anti-free trade and anti-EU movements, this new dynamic will continue to be a hot-button political issue in Europe over the next few years. It will present the European Union and its mission of celebrating multinationalism, free trade, and